Good evening. You are tuned to KRCB's Book Club of the Air, a special this evening talking about Harper Lee's classic To Kill a Mockingbird, the subject of Sonoma County's Big Read, which everybody's been indulging in all during the month of October. I'm Suzanne Lang. I'm your host and moderator this evening, and this is a chance for you to call in and talk with us about this great book. And I am not in the studio alone. I invite you to talk with a couple other people in conversation this evening. I'm going to give out the number first, though, because I hope you will feel like calling and talking to us. It's 584-2020. That's 707-584-2020. I'm here with Mira Katz, Associate Professor in English Education at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California. And if I have this right, you teach people who are going to be teachers. You educate educators. Well, welcome to you, Mira.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here, and some of my English ed students just hosted an event at Sonoma State last night that was quite wonderful. We had 35 high schoolers from Point Arena with their teacher, Wendy Platt, and a handful of parents come down to watch the movie with us. We've all read the book, and so we watched the movie together and had some pizza and had a talk afterwards, and it was quite wonderful.
Fabulous. Well, I'm glad you're here to carry on the conversation. And joining Mira and I in the studio is Waits Taylor, a local author who's just published a book on the Czech artist Alfons Mucha and his Slav epic. It's a set of 20 huge paintings depicting the history of the Slavic people. So congratulations on the publication of that book, Waits.
Thank you.
And you're currently working on a book titled Our Southern Home, A Memoir of the South and Change. And I think that's really what brought you to my attention, that you're from the South, and I think you'll have a unique perspective to bring to us this evening. So welcome, Waits Taylor.
Well, thank you, and it's just a pleasure to be here. And just a brief background on that, I am from the state of Alabama. I was born in Birmingham and raised throughout the state my younger years, and in fact lived in a small town very similar to Monroeville or Macomb, the city in the book. It was a town of about 5,000 people with a town square just like in Macomb. I felt right at home when I read that book, yeah, right after it came out in 1960.
Well, I hope we'll get to talk more about that, because Macomb certainly is almost a character in the book To Kill a Mockingbird.
That's right.
And I invite you, our listeners, to call in this evening and talk to us about this book that I'm sure many of you have read in high school. Maybe you've read it many times. I was talking to somebody the other day, and she said she had read the book 7 times, and she was in her 60s. And so that is quite an influence that book has had on her. Maybe you've only seen the film To Kill a Mockingbird, the 1962 film with Gregory Peck, and perhaps you have some impressions of that, or maybe you find the whole story of Harper Lee as an author rather interesting and enigmatic. However, you want to come to this evening, we're certainly hoping that you will drive the conversation by giving us a call at the area code is 707 and the number is 584-2020. And something I think that we'll be talking about this evening is really the continued relevance of a book that was published over 40 years ago. And we are living in such incredible times right now of having such dramatic events happening in our lives and around us, and I think that the entire society of our country is really engaged in in a dialogue even that is manifested right now, one could say even in this presidential election, we have a man of color running who may become our president of the United States in just under a week. Or we may have somebody else be our president. We don't know. But a book like this speaks to these large issues, like all good classics do, having archetypal characters that really speak to us and live through the years and these episodes. So, Mira, I see you nodding your head about this, so please enter in.
I've done a lot of thinking about the dimensions of the book that keep us coming back to it and keep it on the reading lists in high schools. And I'm just struck by how relevant it remains, especially with regard to issues of social justice and compassion and developing a sense of morality in young people. And, you know, I think we get to watch that evolve in Jem and Scout and Dill. And it's quite wonderful. I mean, I think we actually see them maturing as moral beings. And I think as readers, we see different things each time we read the book or see the movie. There are things that stand out to us depending on where we are ourselves.
Yeah, I certainly agree with what Mira said. I would add to that, you know, the book is, many people start out by saying it's a coming-of-age story of the two young children in the book, and it is that. But I think it goes well beyond that boundary. And in fact, I think one of the major themes of the book is the racial situation in the South at the time and the injustice of that, and the situation between blacks and whites is illustrated by Calpurnia, the maid, by Reverend Sykes, the minister, and so forth. And it illustrates to some sense where we've come today now with Barack Obama running for president. But we can talk more about that in a bit.
And I think following on what Waits is suggesting, I think there's also perhaps a societal coming of age, which is part of what draws us back to the book again and again.
Mm-hmm. And some might suggest that that is indeed the process that we are experiencing right now in this election and in the society. I mean, we have a ballot measure that is asking us to vote whether everybody could even get married who wants to get married. And that is a pivotal question in our society, and it certainly seems like in To Kill a Mockingbird, they were dealing with these kind of very large issues in very many different ways. And the simultaneity of this coming-of-age story where there's this maturation and this dawning awareness, and then this very hard social thing going on with the trial situation is really quite remarkable to be brought together in one book. And I'm really interested in how some of you, our listeners right now, related to some of the things that we're talking about. I wonder how you read the book as a coming-of-age story, or I know our good friend Rosemary Manchester, who hosts A Novel Idea, when she reads a book, she just relates to the characters as if they're human beings, and that is a way to read a book. And others of us might take it more metaphorically or in a more sense with more remove in a way. But I'm interested in how some of you have read the book and how you've related to Kill a Mockingbird, to maybe some of the characters, Atticus Finch or Scout. Was Scout a very inspirational person for you, as, you know, some people grow up and name their daughter Scout based on the book? Or I've been told that some people choose the profession of law because they were so inspired by Atticus Finch. So I'm looking forward to hearing what some of you might have gotten from this book. And I'll give you that number again. It's 707-584-2020. 20 is the number for you to call and help us out here in this conversation.
I wanted to mention, I'm remembering one of the discussions I had with my Sonoma State students a few weeks back when we read this book, and I had one student who said that she loved her father enormously, but that if she had to choose another father, it would definitely be Atticus.
So it did inspire her.
Yeah.
You know, earlier, a few minutes ago, you were talking about, you mentioned Calpurnia, and I think that she was such an interesting character in the book because she really did teach us a lot about what a person did at the time of almost having this dual identity, one when she was in her community and one she was in the white people's house, but that it was Calpurnia who taught Scout how to read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was quite wonderful, too.
Well, I think that is a very much a strong sub-theme of the book is the black-white relationship in the period of time she wrote it, which was in the 1930s. And it's an issue I'm struggling with in the book I'm writing now, Our Southern Home, in trying to explain and come to grips with my life growing up in the segregated South and some of the awful things that happened. And you have Calpurnia later in the book taking the two young children to the black church where they are warmly received, with one exception, who the minister turns out of the church immediately. And I can tell you, having gone to a white church in a small southern town in the late 40s, early 50s, two black children coming into the church would not have been received like that. And then there's a scene later in the book at the end of the trial after Tom Robinson is found guilty, and Atticus packs his briefcase, and instead of walking out the back of the courtroom, he walks out the aisle down the middle of the courtroom, and all the blacks in the balcony, which is where they have to sit, stand up, and also Scout and Jim are up there because they couldn't find a seat downstairs. And Scout is so transfixed with her father as he's walking out, she doesn't notice that all the blacks have risen, including her brother. And finally, Reverend Sykes says to her, "Miss Jean Louise, Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passing." And the level of respect you see in that book of blacks for whites, in spite of the segregation and the racial prejudice they suffered, was very real. But it was not reciprocated in the other way, as we well know. At best, it was paternalistic. And whether she intended that as a strong theme, it comes out to me as a very strong sub-theme in the book.
And moves you greatly.
Oh, it moves me very much.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And with this sort of racial divide that is so explicit in the book, and part of the book is a challenge in a way to reshape that. Mira, I wonder what some of the challenges of teaching a book like this are.
Well, I guess I'll go right to the heart of one of the most challenging things, which is the repeated appearance of the word nigger in the text. And I think, and I can speak for myself as well, it makes my students, for good reason, very uncomfortable. And I think it's almost to the point of being a visceral, kind of a physical response to all the associations that word raises in our minds. And so I think there's been controversy about whether to teach it or not because of the presence of that word in the book. So I think it's still a challenge, I would say. And that tells us something significant, I think, about where we are as a culture.
Mm-hmm.
If it's still that difficult to say and talk about.
Well, I'm very encouraged to hear Mira say that her students are reacting that strongly to the use of the N-word. In my book, in parts of it, when the period I'm writing about the Scottsboro Boys case in the 1930s, the word is predominantly used in the trial and so forth, and I can't use it because the word sticks in my throat. So as far as I can go is N hyphenated, and footnote the first time I do that and explain why, because the word has such a negative connotation in our culture. Even though today young blacks use it, throw it around amongst each other in their jive talk and in their raps as if, you know, it means nothing, but they just fail to understand, at least seem to fail to understand, the deep roots of the nastiness of the word.
Well, it could be a way of reclaiming, and I think we could go on and talk about this a little bit more, but I want to invite you, our listeners, to call in and maybe respond to some of these issues that we're bringing up here. There are some very difficult issues that are approached in the book, not merely the racial one and the use of the word, but also the whole character of Boo Radley on a whole nother trajectory presents some challenges as well. So I want to invite you to call in and engage with us here in the studio. We would really welcome hearing from you. And the number is 707-584-2020. And maybe you are a student of the book, have read it in school, and it's fresh in your mind. And I'd be very curious to know some of your reactions to the book. So the number is 707-584-2020. So Mira, in teaching, you do encourage your students to kind of fully embrace the language of the book.
I wouldn't say that I encourage or discourage, but it's clear to me. I also teach a course in explorations in language, which is really sort of a linguistics course for educators or future educators, and we talk about these issues a lot in those kinds of classes too, and how, as you mentioned, the young African American men and women use the word today in a way that it's inflected differently, and I think it is, in some sense, a reappropriation of, or an appropriation of the word, and of course, it matters who says it a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. So, for any of us to say it is one thing, and for members of other communities to say it is another.
Well, that I think we might have a caller on the line, but maybe not. Well, I hope so, because we're looking forward to hearing from you, and I think that we're just really touching on some of the issues that make the book challenging to read, and I'd really love to explore some of the notions that make this book a very loving testament as well.
Well, I'd like to talk about another character who is very much a secondary character in the book, but getting back to this issue we're talking about of race, it's a white character. His name is Dolphus Raymond. And he was a white man married to a black, well, lived with a black woman and fathered several black children by her. And to survive in the community, he had to act like a drunk. Even though he didn't drink, he had a bottle of Coke in a brown bag and always was acting like he was stoned. But there were people like that in the community, but very few.
Well, we have William on the line from Santa Rosa. William? Are you there? I'm happy that you have called us in this evening. William, what is it that you want to talk about this evening about To Kill a Mockingbird?
Well, I'm actually one of Mira's students from her English 343 class.
Aha! True confession.
I had the pleasure of being able to work with Mira and the other students in our class, along with the students from Point Arena. And in watching the movie and to sort of build upon your comments about this issue of human rights, I think that Harper Lee's novel does a great job of focusing on this conflict of race in our society, but I think she also writes it in such a way that we can feed in these other issues of human rights and use the story as a backdrop to that. For example, with you were alluding to the Proposition 8, the issue of marriage, and is that a right that should be provisioned to all? But in addition to that, we also in the state of California deal with the rights of immigrants, and that deals with legal and both non-legal immigrants into the state, and just the sort of idea as to human rights and who determines who deserves these rights. And in watching the film last night, and Gregory Peck in his speech as Atticus Finch, he makes a statement about how in a court of law that's the only place that someone can be considered equal with their peers. And I felt it appropriate that to address the concern. I think in our schools we really tend to focus on this issue of race.
Well, thank you, William.
Yeah, thanks, Will.
It seems that, did you encounter, what was your experience with the high school students? You just had this viewing last night? Oh, he's gone. I'm sorry, William. Thanks for calling, William. Pardon me?
Sorry, the call dropped. I don't know exactly where it dropped out.
Oh, well, you dropped back in, so thanks so much. And I'm wondering how that experience was for you of viewing the film and having discussions with these high school students from Point Arena.
Well, I think a lot of times students aren't given the intellectual credibility that they deserve. And as adults, sometimes I think people have the tendency to think that they can't handle material that has such charged content as what the book presents. And kids are very smart, regardless of their age. And I think it's an important fact to just to acknowledge that they're able to process this knowledge. And just some of the comments that the students would make in terms of the racial issue, but also this issue of rights, was just moving to actually see students process that information and show that they do have the ability to respond in an intellectual and proactive manner.
Well, I agree with most of what Will said, and especially about the students having, the young people having the intellectual curiosity and knowledge to deal with a subject like In To Kill a Mockingbird and other books that you hear about being banned, like Catcher in the Rye and so forth and so on. And that's a strong statement, and I certainly agree with it.
Thanks for the call, William, and I think we're lucky to have somebody like you as moving into the teaching force.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes. And we have another call, Lori from Sebastopol. Lori?
Enjoying this discussion.
Lori.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, I turned my radio off so I don't hear myself, but I'm really glad we're having this discussion. And talking about the subject of prejudice, it was such a surprise ending. There's all kinds of prejudice, including prejudice against people like Boo Radley, who are in a class of their own. But yet, in the end, he was very quiet. He was very withdrawn from society, but there was a lot going on in him, like, say, Emily Dickinson, who lived on, mainly spent most of her life in the upstairs attic of her father's house, rarely leaving it and doing all that writing. Anyway, I didn't know I was going to compare Boo Radley to her.
Well, hey, that worked, and I am going to ask you to elaborate a little bit more about Boo Radley, because he certainly is an interesting and really a complex character. He doesn't appear a lot in the book, but when he does, it's riveting. What do you make of him, Lori?
Well, he may have a form of genius. As I said, I feel that he's in a class of his own, and there's just so much phoniness written into what we call civilized behavior. It's so false. That's why, in Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger keeps bringing out that Holden Caulfield really just wants to be with children or animals because they don't lie. I mean, there's no pretension. And maybe Boo Radley has the same thing going on. He's very withdrawn because he knows people aren't saying what they truly mean often. And he obviously can see through a person's genetic strain, whether they're, you know, whatever their skin tone is, he sees far beyond that. And most of the people around him, I guess, don't. So he's just withdrawn more into his own world. But he's so withdrawn and but still watching and observing that when it really came time to come out, he really does save the day and do what needs to be done. And I wanted to just say that I feel that we're moving into a time we're going to transcend everything. It's like the fire is heating up in so many ways now. We're driving the fever up and it's going to go back down, and we're going to go over this hump of absolute insanity, and we're going to see past even our prejudice against non-humans and see that we're all part of this web of life, and that we're all integral parts, and we're all interacting at all times.
Well, thank you for your call, and Lori, for your sense of hopefulness as well.
I'd like to add to Laurie that I think that's an insightful comment about Boo, and that he probably was incredibly intelligent. And I think it's illustrated where he was when he turned to the children as his principal source of contact outside the house, and the relationship he developed with them, which led to the ending.
And what's so interesting is that while they are ever present in his mind, and we know that because of the little gifts he leaves them, he is certainly ever present in theirs. And so it's this wonderful relationship without any physical contact or even eye contact or interaction. It all happens sort of at a distance.
Until the very end when it is critical, and even that final scene of Scout walking hand in hand with taking Boo Radley home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I get goosebumps just even thinking of it now,
right,
that when she says that's the last time she ever saw him. I want to welcome Anne from Rohnert Park, another caller from Rohnert Park.
Oh, hello.
Oh, hi, Anne.
Hi. This is Anne Convery. I am also, I guess, a past student of Mira's and a current TA for her for this particular class that helped host the event last night at Sonoma State. Hi. As I was circulating with the high school kids last night in groups with our class, one thing that I was getting from a lot of those younger students was that they felt that maybe the book, although powerful and although they enjoyed the story, wasn't as pertinent in terms of race. And I know that there's been a lot of conversation in the media about moving into this post-race society, that we're in a post-race discussion, that this presidential election, it's post-race. And while I want to honor the students' move towards that and this really positive move towards viewing our society as post-race here in America, you know, as an older student, you know, and as a graduate student, and as someone who's experienced, you know, racism in both sides of the coin, I also don't know how we walk that line between honoring their really positive volition towards post-race, but then also pointing out that we can't, you know, kind of put the cart before the horse, so to speak.
Yeah, I think we know that colorblindness has gotten us into trouble before, and I would say that it's likely to get us in trouble again. So,
well, there may be a bright cloud in that, though, in that this generation and all these, especially the younger voters that are lining up to vote in this election, are much less colorblind than my generation, I'm sure Mira's generation, and hopefully, you know, that will continue. And Barack Obama has tried to conduct his campaign in a colorblind sense, trying, you know, not to make race an issue one way or the other, just I am a good man and the best man for the job. And so in that context, I would hope that's a hopeful sign, but it could I share your concern that things could drift back easily.
Thank you, Anne, for calling in and sharing with us this evening.
Thank you. Wonderful program.
Thanks. I think we're going to take a short break now, and we'll be taking some more calls after the break. The number you can call is 707-584-2020. I'm Suzanne Lang, and I'm here with Mira Katz and Waits Taylor. This is KRCB's Book Club of the Air. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, and I hope you'll stay with us.
I don't know how my mother walked her trouble down. I don't know how my father stood his ground. I don't know how my people survived slavery. Overflow their veins. I don't know why the snow falls and covers the ground. I don't know why the hurricane sweeps through the land every now and then. Standing in a rainstorm, I believe.
I want to welcome you. You are listening to KRCB's Book Club of the Air. I'm Suzanne Lang, and I'm here with Mira Katz, who is Associate Professor of English Education at Sonoma State University, and with author Waits Taylor, who hails from the South and has an interesting connection because of that, and that seems to be why the book resonates a lot with you.
Absolutely.
And we are inviting you to drive this conversation about Harper Lee's great novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. There's still so much for us to talk about here. And the number is 707-584-2020. There's so many different ways to talk about the book. In fact, we are... because we're involved in this presidential election that is really kind of us facing many things about ourselves as a society, it seems very appropriate to talk about it in that way. But there are other aspects of the book that are just as challenging, I think. For instance, even Harper Lee herself is an enigmatic character who is very interesting. She wrote this one book that has not only defined her as an author, but has defined a whole element of our society. And she did not go on to write another book. And she had this intriguing relationship with Truman Capote. There have been two films made. Capote was made, and then Infamous was another film that was made about just about that, about their relationship with each other. So maybe that is of interest to you. I know I found it marvelous, and the films were good too. So 584-2020 is the number to call if you'd like to talk about any of these or something completely different. Waits?
Well, you bring up Truman Capote, and he's fascinating in his relationship to Nell Harper Lee and the book. Truman lived in the small town of Monroeville in the 30s when both she and Harper grew up. And he is the character Dill in the book, although Harper Lee denies it. When you read the description of him and the relationship to Scout, who is also Harper Lee, in the it's really a biography.
In fact, there is a biography out there called I Am Scout.
Yes, right.
We have a caller on the line, Deidre from Healdsburg. Deidre, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to say the thing that jumped out for me at the end of the book is the line where Scout's going through the seasons, and the line, it says, autumn again and Boo's children needed him. And it just so jumped out because as I was reading that, I was thinking, of course, it's Atticus's children. And then, you know, in thinking about this, I thought, and Atticus would say, you know, we have to walk in one's shoes in order to know, you know, how they feel and who they are. That, in essence, we're really all one. And you see this through the eyes of a child. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the gentleman who was with a black woman and had act like a town drunk, and Scout was so puzzled by that. Like, you know, why would adults have to do something like that? But as you become an adult, you develop these schemes, and then you develop prejudices. And, you know, the essence of the story, I think, is Atticus in that you rise above it. You do your darndest to have reason and judgment and rise above it. And you see, you know, prejudice through the eyes of the teacher who thought Hitler was so bad, but then after the trial would go on about Tom Robinson and that, you know, just how blacks are blacks and, you know, and how Scout was so puzzled by that. And I just thought, you know, it's just, you know, we encompass all of this.
And you felt that phrasing at the end of the book kind of crystallized that for you?
Well, it just, you know, Boo being this distant character, and all of a sudden it's Boo's, it's his children.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, you know, you just this man that the children were so afraid of, and it just sort of brought the everything to get the human race together, you know, like crystallized that.
That's big. That's
yeah.
big, Deidre.
Well,
thanks so much for your call, Deidre.
Another
thank
aspect
you.
Of the point I think Deidre's making was Jim's reaction to the verdict and how distraught he was about it, because having sat in the courtroom as a young 13 or 14-year-old boy and listening to the testimony, he was absolutely convinced the jury would find Tom Robinson innocent. And he just had a heck of a time dealing with it and overcoming it, and Atticus had to counsel him on that. And that, again, was a part of coming of age or understanding in that society they lived in at the time, which was so biased against black people.
Yes, yes. Well, we have a call on the line. Diana from Petaluma? Oh, she's not here yet. I'm just being a little clairvoyant on that one. Oh, here she is. Diana, are you there?
Yes. Suzanne, thank you. Thank you for facilitating this discussion. It's been wonderful.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. I'm a past student of Mira's, and I'd like to discuss something that I've not heard brought up yet, and that's the depiction of the media in the book and the movie. It ends where Boo Radley or Ewell's death. Mr. Ewell's death is depicted as an accident, so that attention's not brought to Boo Radley. And that reminded me then of the telephone call that Atticus receives notifying him of Tom Robinson's death. As reported, it was reported that the shot was hoped to be that would injure him, but in fact killed him instead. And because the ending The report was modified, augmented to save who. It was then altered also, perhaps, and this is only perhaps, to make it look as if Tom Robinson was trying to escape, but in fact could have been something else.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, both points are true. And I think whichever you think about Tom running, escaping, or just frightened, he was very clearly killed intentionally.
Yes.
This sort of thing happened in that period in the South frequently with black prisoners. And to, let's see, what was the other point you made?
Just that it probably was that he was murdered, not
yeah,
that it
right.
was an attempt to injure him, and that the
yeah.
story then was just altered to make it look better than it was. For
well,
the
no, it certainly was by the sheriff and by the
yeah.
authorities. And the other thing, the thing with Boo Radley at the end was not the media, at least as you inferred when you started. That was Sheriff Tate's
yes.
position and decision, and it was a very personal moral decision. Rather than to go forward as Atticus was initially talking about doing.
Exactly, yes.
Well, thank you, Diana. And Mira just has a great swell of students out mm-hmm. there, and former students, so an inspirational teacher. I'm sure your next class will be booked.
Indeed, she is.
Well, great.
Right.
And
thank you.
You're welcome. And Mira, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, there are a lot of mirrored events, you know, sort of parallel events throughout the book, like the ones that Diana just pointed out. And I was thinking that one of the most moving scenes for me is at the end when Atticus first thinks he's going to have to send his son off to be tried, and Heck Tate says, no. You know, Mr. Yule fell on that knife and killed himself. Let the dead bury the dead. And in the film, Gregory Peck picks up Scout, and so they're about at eye level, and she explains to him why putting Boo Radley behind bars or trying him would be the equivalent of killing a mockingbird. And it's such a lovely moment where this young person, 7 or 8 or 9, is really sort of teaching her father what he's already taught her. And for me, what that scene echoes back to is them sitting together, and she's very upset because her teacher's told her she can't read anymore. And he has a long discussion with her about compromise. Do you understand the word compromise?
Mm-hmm.
And her first response is, bending the law? And he says, well. And then, you know, they have a long discussion about that. But it feels to me like those two things
meet up. Things are mirrors
meet up.
Of each other.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. And David from Santa Rosa. Welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, hi. I wanted to go back a few minutes in the conversation because when I called, I couldn't get in as quickly.
That's fine.
As I hoped. And I also wanted to add before I start that I wanted to say that I live over in a junior college neighborhood here, and we have a movie night, and the movie that we showed this 2 weeks ago was To Kill a Mockingbird, to try to get into the spirit of the book club.
Well, great.
So, and we had a good turnout. It's a great movie, of course. But the thing that I wanted to pass on here and see if anybody would care to pick up on it is that I've always kind of thought of Boo Radley as sort of the conscience of the South. And he was, of course, hidden away and tucked away, and he had stabbed his father because the father being the man who cemented up the giving tree and things like that. And it kind of seems that he performed the function of a conscience. And I won't come off the air, get off the phone so I can listen to the discussion.
But I first want to tell you, David, that is an interesting perspective that I'd never really thought of, and you touch on some good points, especially about the whole start, I want to say the start of Boo Radley being where he stabbed his father in the leg, but that's what is revealed to us. I think what you intimate is that there may have been some abuse or something that drove him to do that. And I like your interpretation. Thanks for the call, David.
Okay.
I've never thought of Boo in that context as a consciousness of the novel. It's an interesting idea. I'd have to think more about it. In thinking about it, and I've read it a number of times and thought about it a lot and read about Harper Lee, he's never jumped out to me in quite that context, but interesting idea.
Yeah, I agree that it's an interesting idea. I also think there's a lot of evidence throughout the book, perhaps subtle, that he is abused and acts that act of aggression of, you know, supposedly stabbing his father with the scissors is really a kind of I can't take it anymore response.
The other thought about that is it true?
Is
it true that he stabbed his father?
Right, we don't even know
the way
that.
The story's told, it's not clear.
Right.
You could take it either way.
And we do have the sense that the father is not a very nice person.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I want to quickly give out the number again. We have some open lines here in the studio, and we're anxious to hear what you have to say about this book. I've so appreciated your calls, and I think it's a great way to look at the book and bring us some new ideas. We have a caller on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, it's Robin.
Hi, Robin.
In Santa Rosa.
Great.
So I was interested when Deirdre was talking about Boo Radley, and she mentioned that the kids were afraid of Boo Radley. It made me think that I think one of the things he stands for is what racism is all about, that the kids were behaving out of fear and behaving actually quite reprehensibly. They were taunting him and talking about doing terrible things to him. And it's not unlike some of what we've been seeing on the national stage lately, with some people behaving in incredibly racist ways toward Barack Obama and actually calling out threatening taunts and some pretty terrifying things. I think that a lot of what racism is about is fear of the unknown, so I think that's another way to think about Boo Radley.
Certainly. Thanks a lot for the call, Robin, and that perspective.
Well, I think that's an interesting perspective of Robin, but it is certainly true that children of that age can be pretty cruel to others, like they were to Boo or to kids in their classroom.
And children of any age, because
exactly.
That's what we're, to wit, what's happening today right in the
exactly.
media. Yes, yes. Mira?
I was just thinking, listening to Robin's comment, that Martin Luther King speaks quite eloquently about fear, and just as she said, as fear of that fear of the unknown drives a good deal of our interactions at a social and societal level, and I think we're still living with a good bit of that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, yes. The number you can call here, we still would like to continue this great conversation we're having about Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, a classic American novel that I think we're discovering has certainly a lot of relevance today, 40 years after it was written, but really resonates in very many ways on very many levels. And then there seems to be a confluence by the end of the book with the themes. But the whole coming-of-age thing, and I think Harper Lee handles in such a stunning way of having this voice of an adult reminiscing at a certain point of her life, but that voice of her as a child coming out so clearly and distinctly, and that that kind of duality of the adult and the child being the same person and coming out so clearly. And we could actually see scout having awareness develop, and I think that is such a testament to Harper Lee as an author.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, she does that so skillfully.
Interestingly enough, when the book first came out, there were several critics who reviewed the book who were very critical of the way she handled Scout, because she moved from speaking in a childlike voice in one scene to a few pages later she'd be speaking as she was older, which she was, moving back and forth. And obviously the critics got it wrong. The rest of us got it right. We enjoyed it very much.
We have a caller, Jackie, from Rohnert Park. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was interested in the comment that you guys opened the program with about relevance and how this text has sort of stood the test of time. And I'm interested because I feel like this text, especially since you know we are talking about it being read by young adults as well as adults, that it's sort of crossing boundaries in terms of age groups, but as well as historical lines. And so I was just curious about what you guys think about why it is so relevant amongst groups, adults and young adults alike.
And I'm happy to address that. But Jackie, do you have a notion about that?
Well, I was thinking a lot about what you were saying about metaphor and how we there's different ways to read text. One of them could be we sort of embody the characters. We see ourselves within them. And also that we sort of take each of these scenes or each of these characters sort of maybe on an archetypal level as more of a metaphorical way of looking at the world. And I believe that, we do a combination of both, and that, you guys have been bringing up such amazing points about the current election and about race and how these are things are so relevant. And I feel that we come to these conclusions and are able to make these connections across time because of our ability as readers, that when we read text, we both become the character. We use the text and these other characters as a mirror to see our own selves as well as our own communities and our own histories and society. And then at the same time, I feel that language itself is metaphorically based, and it's a natural way for us to be thinking. And I think in terms of in that way, I feel that it makes sense that young adults as well as adults are finding relevance within this text. And I feel like it's very important that we are teaching, and that there's a reason that this book is still as important today as it was, 10, 20 years ago.
Well, thank you. I think you answered your own question, and I really appreciate you, Jackie, raising the issue. Thanks so much for the call. And
thank you.
Why don't we continue on that thought?
Yeah, I think Jackie's perceptions and her insights about metaphor are apt, and I would add to what she was saying in terms of thinking about how we connect with a text when we read it. I think that this is a book that teaches empathy and compassion at so many different levels, and I think if you're young, you probably learn those things by watching or, connecting with Scout and Dill and Jem. And if you're an adult, you might focus a lot more on Atticus and Calpurnia and Aunt Alexandra and Uncle Jack. Mm-hmm. And and Miss Maudie across the street. And I just think that there are so many people, Reverend Sykes, who embody those qualities, and it's like Harper Lee gives us multiple opportunities to have these insights no matter how old we are when we read, which is why some of us, as you said, read it seven times.
Yes. And the prose is really so amazing because it doesn't get in its own way. It's almost invisible, and that it's easy to just melt into the story because of that, and again, a testament to Harper Lee.
I think that's another strong point. Beside all of the issues that the book has raised that we've discussed and the metaphorical issues that are so strong and predominant in the book, at its roots, it's just a hell of a good story. And it, as you talk about the writing, without even letting your brain go in those directions, you can just curl up and just enjoy it.
It's true.
And then as you sit back and think about it, these issues and these questions about what did I just read, where is that coming from and where is that going, start to ferment in your brain. But if it wasn't a good read and a good story, that'd be the end of the day.
It does have this amazing sense of pacing, that it moves along, and no chapter is too long or too short, and it seems like it shifts from chapter to chapter, telling a little bit different story here, and then it comes back a little later on, and, mm-hmm. and just keeps you on the hook in a way, and keeps you inviting you in more and more.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. And I want to invite just one more caller, if we can, because we're bumping up to the top of the hour, but we still have a few minutes left. If you have some final thoughts, as we'll be wrapping up, if you have a little wrap-up thought, you can give us a call at 584-2020. But yes, I think that the whole notion of a good story has basic elements, these compelling episodes even. I think there are episodes in To Kill a Mockingbird that I may not remember all the little details of the story, but a certain episode stands out in my mind. I know the scene with the dog, of the shooting of mm-hmm. the dog yeah. As it's weaving down the street, and just that that Atticus could shoot that dog. But he didn't really want to. I think he didn't want his kids to see him do that, and I think he had this thing about guns, and yet at that moment, just the way that scene was described by Harper Lee was so visual and visceral.
Absolutely.
And very well done in the film as well.
Right.
Jem's little eyes kind of pop out when he sees his father, and then I think it's Heck Tate says, "Don't you know your father's the best yeah, shot in the county?"
Jem is questioning his father's manhood. He won't play football.
Right.
He won't do this. He won't do that. And when he sees this, he's just blown away.
Yeah, and they're always talking about how old Atticus is, too.
Oh, yes.
He's so old. He won't do anything. Can't do anything anymore.
But it is a great story about kids and their dad.
Yeah.
Kids and their dad.
Single parent.
Yes.
Another element we hadn't mentioned.
Yes.
But we have
yes.
a single parent.
With a lot of help from Calpurnia.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, well, as we're discovering, there's still so much to talk about, but we have run out of time. And so I need to quickly thank everybody who took the time to call in and make this such a dynamic conversation this evening. And I really would like to thank you both, Mira Katz, Associate Professor of English Education at Sonoma State University, and Waits Taylor, author, just has a book out and is writing another one. So I hope to see you both again, and thanks so much for participating in the conversation.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Thanks for having us.
And I want to remind you, our listeners, that you can tune in every single Wednesday night here on KRCB at 7 o'clock for some sort of literary or cultural programming. And aren't we fortunate to have such an opportunity here every week at 7 on KRCB. Coming up next is Connections, but I've sure been happy to be here this evening and happy to have you listening and participating. And we're going to go out with the lovely, lovely, stunning Elmer Bernstein score from the movie To Kill a Mockingbird. Thanks so much.